The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
The sound columnist of the Times Ireland edition, Roe McDermott, who is film and fashion editor with Hot Press, and Michael Cogley, who's also with the Times Ireland edition. Thank you all for joining us. You're going to be stuck with us for a while. We'll try and organise some drink maybe for you as well. You
might need like it. A decent Christian food.
Okay, where to start? You know what? I'm going to start actually with a little bit of audio of one of the figures of the year, one of the most disruptive figures of the year, Nigel Farage. This is his latest today, celebrating Brexit, celebrating the news that the British passport is going to be, after they have Brexit, blue rather than burgundy.
We have got a, I'm calling it, Brexmas present, and we're told we're going to get our passports back. It's the first real, tangible victory that we've had since that referendum, and it's something we should celebrate.
But you reflect on the last couple of months, and a few weeks ago you were clearly not happy after those all-night talks in Brussels when Theresa May said a deal had been done, you know, to allow movement on to the next stage of talks on trade, and you said this isn't Brexit. So does the passport, the colour of the passport, the wording on the passport, does that really represent a major step forward for you?
No, it is a tangible gain. And that's something, but goodness me, there is an awful lot more to do. And we really do need a government with some courage and with some vision. And at the moment, that does appear to be sadly lacking.
That was on BBC News this morning. Roe McDermott, the idea of the colour of your passport being important to you.
I just find it so ironic that he's calling for vision, and to him this is a tangible win. I mean, it's such a, I mean, in the words of Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, she said this idea of bringing back the blue cover was insular, inward-looking and nonsense. And I think it couldn't have been said better myself.
But why does it matter what colour your passport is, as long as your passport gets you into the countries you want to get into?
Well, you know, they can. I'm looking forward to watching them all.
Sorry, this is Lise Hand. Sorry, Lise.
Yes, the one and only. I'm really looking forward to them all lining up at various airports with their blue passports and watching all the EU citizens whiz by them through the fast lane. And, you know, it's also interesting that the number of applications made from Britain for Irish passports from Irish people who are eligible for it, 81,000 this year. Went through the ceiling. It was only about 50, I think it was 60 something last year after Brexit, and now it's 80 something this year.
You know what? I think the latest figures put double that.
Could it be?
It's double. It's about 160,000.
That could be north. That's probably
quick
north.
Google search is required here.
No, I think that is actually, I think your figure might be the north of Ireland and the rest of the UK combined, I think. I think it's about 80 in each, which is insane. I mean, let's not quibble over that. I mean, it's insane figures. It's totally bonkers. And, you know, I can't wait to see what Nigel Farage does when they get their straight bananas. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the man is just a preposterous little goon. And every time I see him, I start hearing the music from Dad's Army behind him, you know, because this is kind of where we're at. These sort of, you know, preposterous little men kind of going around, you know, standing at the White Cliffs of Dover going, you know, we'll repel all, you know, all invaders. I mean, if it actually wasn't so serious, it would be hilarious.
But I've just thought of something, Michael, that could be very worrying to us, that when it happens that they do leave the European Union and they have to go through passport control for their holidays in France, Spain and the rest of it, because we're not part of the Schengen Agreement. You know, we actually have to carry our passports in continental Europe as the Europeans don't. Hopefully everywhere in Europe will have a separate queue for the Irish. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we don't end up having to get in the same queues as this lot.
Surely not. Well, it depends, because what Lise is saying there is that the fact that they're leaving Europe, they'll have much longer queues. But in Dublin Airport, it's the Europeans that are clogged up. So maybe this is all just a giant ruse, and this is his decided interest in that he's finally gotten his blue passport so that he can skip everyone else and into the 10 British out of the 100 Europeans that go through. So the lining might actually work out in their favour, I'd say, at the airport.
I think generally what it points to is something that has been so prevalent this year. It's this idea of defining nationalism as who we aren't in opposed to who we are. And I think the statement of we're going to change the colour of the passport and that will separate us further, and this is a huge statement about who we are. It's not a statement about who Britain is. It's who they don't want to be and don't want to include. And I find that such a narrow-minded idea that I think has infected politics plastics so prevalently this year.
But is Leo Varadkar falling into that category a little bit as well? Because the one thing that perhaps has surprised some people about Leo Varadkar is how nationalist he seems to have been, and Simon Coveney as Minister for Foreign Affairs, in dealing with the North as part of the whole Brexit issue.
Yeah, I think this is one of the big tests of Leo Varadkar, because he is still quite new to the job, and it is one of this first test of international diplomacy and relationships between Britain. And I think there is a pressure on him that he might be slightly overstating a little bit in his responses to firmly set out who Ireland is, their relationship with Britain. And because of this pushback then from unionists, he might be taking it. Yeah, he is. I mean, the rhetoric is getting very heated.
Yeah, well, maybe it's... he might approve, being a good staunch blue shirt, he might quite be quite into the whole blue passport notion himself. I don't know. But I think he's at two things, maybe even three things here. He is appealing to the Irish people who feel they've been kicked around a lot by outside forces, particularly over the recession and the way we got treated. I think he wants
this
to.
This is
try
not a historical thing. This is over the last decade.
This is over the last decade. Absolutely. You know, where we felt we probably were kicked around a bit by various outside forces, Europe, everybody.
The IMF.
This is the IMF, particularly. So I think this is possibly, you know, installation a bit more of the national pride, sort of say, look, you know, we are going to stand up to these guys. It's also one in the eye for the Sinn Féin, as he'd see it, because he's essentially eating their lunch at the moment, because Sinn Féin are obviously twiddling their thumbs up in the Assembly. They're not sitting in, because of the ridiculous abstentionist policy, they're not sitting in Westminster. So, you know, he's essentially kind of just saying, well, look, you know, we look after the nationalists.
But hold on, could it be to a certain extent that Sinn Féin have almost started sort of pitching for the sort of the left-wing vote, or the politically correct vote? And now, while they're doing that, going for maybe the left-wing audience, Leo Varadkar is trying to get the nationalist middle ground?
Quite possibly, because, I mean, there's you know, a yawning gap on the left, obviously, now, because Labour have, you know, imploded in the last election, and nothing has really taken their, you know, really sort of taken their place in
I'm
Parliament.
I'm sure the Anti-Austerity Alliance and the rest would argue with you, but they're only about 1 or 2%
of
the
vote.
Yeah,
but they're also hard left, and they wouldn't appeal to a lot of people, say, the middle sort of Labour vote. And, you know, I think, I do think Simon Coveney showed a bit of naivety. I think it was in one of the Oireachtas committees at the end of November, kind of before this whole thing kicked off big time. And he made that remark about the fact that he would like to see a united Ireland in his lifetime. Now, he's not really saying anything that most Irish politicians wouldn't say, but at a particularly febrile time, it probably wasn't the best thing, and the unionists, you know, just got the backs up of the unionists.
Because
as well.
Michael, traditionally Fine Gael leaders would not have been as strong on the national unity question as perhaps Fianna Fáil leaders. Now, could it be there's a little bit here that it's as the son of an immigrant as well that Leo Varadkar is showing a little bit more of his nationalism? In one of the jibes that came, for example, from John Taylor, the unionist Lord, whatever he calls it, Lord Kilclooney, when he described Leo Varadkar as the Indian in a tweet a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I think Lord Kilcooney's comments need to be taken with a very severe pinch of salt. But no, I don't think that was affecting his decision-making and his decision-making in terms of the rhetoric that he pursued during those negotiations. I think the way they went about it was that they had a very clear and concise message to convey, and they did that from the very start, and that there wasn't going to be a border in the island of Ireland. And I don't think they ever swayed from that at all. I don't think his stubbornness was born out of anything other than this is what we want to achieve from these talks. And they had a very strong and very powerful veto in that as well. So I think that was his motivation throughout. I don't think it had anything to do with his heritage or anything like that in determining what they wanted to achieve in those talks.
Listener Ian in Belfast says, my last two passports before the Burgundy European ones were black, not blue. Driving licences were blue. That is a point, actually. There are people today online showing their old British passports and they were actually black rather than blue, despite all the fuss being made by the likes of Nigel Farage. Leo Varadkar, of course, became Taoiseach on the 14th of June this year. Mm-hmm. That was as a result of winning the Fine Gael leadership contest against Simon Coveney. Let's remember a little bit of what he said he would want to do when he was elected Taoiseach.
I want to thank Deputy Kenny and Deputy Madigan for nominating me here today. In particular, I want to thank Deputy Kennedy in a very personal way. Yesterday we heard wonderful tributes to his leadership, and I've no doubt that only for him, this country as we know it would not be here today. His leadership also enabled me to become an equal citizen in my own country only 2 short years ago, and to aspire to hold this office, an aspiration which I once thought was beyond my reach, at least if I chose to be myself. I'd also like to thank Deputy Adams for revealing our little secret that we did, in fact, attend the same Pilates class on a number of occasions. I do think he was much better at it than I was. Perhaps perhaps he has greater experience of being in a tight squeeze. Corla, Arthur Griffith, whose monument stands on this Leinster lawn, believed that people could not be moved solely by a cold thing like economics. He said it was rather a question of feeling. What he meant was that if you want to inspire somebody to believe in your vision, you have to appeal to their heart as well as their head. Economics and economic policies on their own were not enough. So the government that I lead will not be one of left or right, because those old divisions don't comprehend the political challenges of today. And while others in the House may be obsessed with the political debates of the 1980s, I can assure you that I am not, and nor will my government. We'll be focused on the solutions of the 21st century and the future. So the government I lead will be one of the new European centre, as we seek to build a republic of opportunity, and that is a republic in which every citizen gets a fair go and has the opportunity to succeed, and in which every part of the country has a chance to share in our prosperity.
And I'll get to that in a second, but Rose, something did strike me there in the earlier part of that clip. And internationally, it was a major event that Leo Varadkar was gay in becoming leader of the country. Whereas it was sort of here was Asher, we dealt with all that a couple of years ago as if there was no real fuss about it.
No, and I think, Anna, he did make Time magazine cover because, I mean, he was a few firsts rolled into one. At 38, he was the country's youngest ever Taoiseach, who's the first person from an ethnic minority background to become Taoiseach. And then, yes, the first to come out of gay, to come out as gay. And I think it was very symbolic of the shift in social values that the country has seen, you know, moving from a staunchly Catholic country. But I almost think Irish society, because we have felt that shift over the past few years, it did feel more natural to us that, of course, we wouldn't stigmatise against anyone for being gay. But then I think we all almost kind of overestimate how far our country has come
because
when we recognise.
He made something very interesting there. He said that a couple of years ago, he felt he wouldn't have been able to have the ambition to become Taoiseach.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference of culture changing on the ground and then being followed by laws like the Marriage Equality Act, that we really feel the shifts rather than laws coming in first and then people catching up. But I think from an international stage, I mean, Ireland is still fighting, you know, for the right to have abortion legalised. I mean, internationally, we're not known as a very progressive country. That reputation as being staunchly Catholic, as being quite oppressive towards certain minorities, that reputation still holds. So I think maybe we were quite naive in thinking like, oh, everybody understands now that we're getting more progressive. But I think we have to show it internationally and show it, continue to do so in the upcoming referendums.
Okay, well, there are those, because we have to be careful because of issues of balance. There will be people who will vote against the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, and that's something that we will probably be spending quite a lot of time on next year on the programme. Some comments coming in. If it's not Thatcher, it was Reagan or McCreevy, etc. in the old days that pinkos like Handon Cooper got stuck into. The new pantomime hit figures are Trump, we'll be getting to him after five, Boris Johnson, Nigel and Leo. Get over yourselves. The people have spoken. They want an end to the multicultural open door nirvana you lot keep ramming down our throats.
I love being called a pinko. That's so cool.
You had constant Brit bashing on your show, and don't worry, Lise, they're not applying for passports because they want to live here.
They are, absolutely, and thank God, because I mean they'd be hard put to find a house for a start. And by the way, I did just check the figure, and the Department of Foreign Affairs, it was 81,000, just over 81,000.
I should have known better than to argue a particular point.
Argue about figures now. In fairness, you're on a good run there, because obviously I'm pretty innumerate generally. But I just going back to the point. I think, you know, Ro was right. You know, we have come an awful long way in this country. I mean, if you recall back when Bertie Ahern was going for the leadership of Fianna Fáil. Yeah, I mean, way back then. And yeah. He was, do you remember, there were snide remarks as to, we would like to know where our Taoiseach sleeps at night. Because at that stage he was, you know, he was a separated man. And he was living shock horror with a woman who, you know, wasn't the wife that he was married to. So some people saw that as outrageous, but a lot of people would have said, well, Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it just goes to show how far we have come. I mean, it's not that long ago.
Let's stay with the Leo Varadkar, though. You know, not left, not right, centrist for the 21st century. When's he going to sort out the homelessness crisis, Lise?
Well, I have a horrible feeling we'll be sitting here this time next year and probably having a deja vu about this conversation today, because it's, he, you know, really has absolutely shockingly little headroom or headway has been made in this absolutely, you know, appalling problem and complete blot on just, I think it's just a blot on society, on the government.
Nearly 9,000 people
nearly
homeless
9,000
going
people.
Into Christmas.
Yeah, and I mean the figures are rising, not falling, and you would like to think it's, you know, a case of it's going to get worse before it gets better, but I'm not sure this is, because they, you know, the government has displayed so little joined up thinking on this. This is the trouble. They have yet to, I think, come up with some kind of cohesive plan that understands that the housing crisis and the homeless crisis, you can't separate them. They're one and the same thing. And instead, you know, instead of just sort of, you know, throwing money piecemeal at one or the other or trying to come up with schemes for one or the other, they just seem to be trying to tackle these as two separate things. And, you know, the simple short answer is, you know, they just need to build more houses. They need to build more social housing, affordable housing.
And that has a knock-on feed-on effect into everything. It's the rental sector, the private ownership sector.
Exactly, because, I mean, the rental sector is an absolute disaster.
There's a couple of things in this, Michael, which surprises me that they haven't got to grips with. That one, it may actually also be costing jobs coming into the country, because employers are now saying there's nowhere for people to live. But also, for getting an electorate angry when the next election comes, how many younger people in particular who are seeing rents going to record highs and who are struggling to save money for deposits to buy their own place are going to react against the government that they hold responsible for that?
Absolutely, and I envisage that will be the case. I've spoken to a few business groups over the last year who've both said very similar things about trying to attract talent. And not only attracting talent, but also Ireland's competitiveness of keeping talent here as well is really going to diminish, because if you look back, I think our rents are 15% above what they were in the Celtic Tiger, but our wages most certainly aren't 15% higher than they were.
And you're taxed more highly as well.
And you're taxed more highly as well. So your quality of living is dipped significantly at the same time. So when it comes to the next election, you're wondering, you know, Sinn Féin have put out an awful lot of policies in terms of bringing up more social housing on stream and investing far more in that regard. So are the younger voters going to latch onto that and say, wait a minute, if these guys have the answers to solving the rental crisis? I mean, if you look at the rents, quarter three came out there last week and the quarter actually accelerated from quarter two and one, and the rent pressure zones came in a year ago. So
rent caps haven't worked. It's a supply issue, as they were told a year ago. Roe McDermott, you were away out of the country for about 3 years until recently, weren't you?
Yeah, I lived in San Francisco, and I think something that really struck me about this is the confusion there is about differing definitions of homeless and how that term is used legally. Because I know Leo Varadkar got in a bit of trouble when he said, you know, our homelessness situation isn't actually that bad compared to in other countries internationally. And I know that I lived in San Francisco, and the homeless population in San Francisco is now nearly 8,000. But that does mean homeless people on the streets.
Oh, yeah.
In opposed to in emergency accommodation. And I know that, you know, San Francisco is geographically the same size as Dublin. The population is roughly the same. So that is a huge amount of people on the streets. And I know coming back when I was hearing about the homeless crisis and then was seeing, oh, you know, there are 96, I think last year, it was 96 people were sleeping rough on the streets of Dublin. And coming from, I was imagining that the amount of people on the streets was getting comparable to San Francisco. But I think that phrasing is now tripping up a lot of politicians and tripping up a lot of studies as well when they're trying to compare the homelessness crisis in different cities. Because I know Theresa May made a statement during the week about homelessness in Britain. And I think that just needs to be really sorted and made clear in the media when people are discussing and trying to compare and contrast situations, which usually isn't particularly helpful. Like comparing a situation in Dublin and San Francisco, it doesn't make the situation in Dublin better.
Coming back after 3 years away, and I know you've been backwards and forwards at times, but how much has Ireland even changed? Because a lot of people are saying, oh, the economic recovery has really taken hold in our cities, but not so much so outside of our cities, that it's been unequally shared, unequal distribution. Do you see a sense of a different Ireland in coming back after being away for 3 years?
Yeah, I found the class issues really interesting, because in Dublin I have felt I came home and Dublin just seemed more affluent. I don't understand our new fascination with donut stores, I have to say. That was one thing that has new popped up that it seems so hipstery and bizarre. But I think class issues generally have just they seem more prevalent and more pressing. And I do think it definitely is a case of major cities versus people down the country who aren't feeling the benefits of, you know, maybe Dublin is recovering and there are a lot more jobs. But also, I think, yeah, the renting crisis, I came back and I work as a writer and a lot of my friends are writers, and coming back to them and saying, you know, none of us made a lot of money, but we could afford to live somewhere. And now the amount of people who've had to move back in with their parents, and again, they're not counted as homeless people, even though they don't
have
houses.
That's a very good point, that there's a generation of people in their 20s who are living with their parents who are not home, but they can't afford to rent or they can't afford to buy.
And they would, in other countries, again, they would be considered homeless. If you're over the age of 30 and you can't afford a house and you're living with your parents, you're included in the figures, but not in Ireland.
That's why Varadkar's comments at the time were extremely watery, to say the least, because the study that he referenced was, first of all, in 2014. Obviously, since 2014, our homelessness crisis has exploded. And also, ours is very specifically down to kind of people in emergency accommodation, where you've other things, you've sofa surfers, you've people staying at home, you've people uncertain accommodation as well, comes into that regard as well. So, like, people in different countries. So, that data that he referred to was forwarded with "don't compare the countries."
Yeah.
You know, so it was incredible to reach for that. But, you're definitely right. Like, the way rents have gone as well, and in Dublin specifically, it gets very depressing when you're working your full 40, 50 hour week and you're not getting anything remotely close to what you should. But I suppose it's the way it is now.
Now, Donald Trump has been the dominant figure of the year internationally since his inauguration last January. It has been an extraordinary year following him. And he has, in his own mind, had lots of magnificent successes. And if he doesn't think that, he has plenty of flunkies around the place to tell him that as well, such as his vice president, Mike Pence. This happened at a cabinet meeting this week. It was filmed and broadcast for everyone to see. This is almost as if it was in North Korea. Wait till you hear how Mike Pence thanked Donald Trump for all the work during his first year as US president.
Mike, would you like to say a few words?
Well, I appreciate it, Mr. President. As I told you last night, shortly after the Senate vote, I know I speak on behalf of the entire cabinet and of millions of Americans when I say congratulations and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for seeing through the course of this year an agenda that truly is restoring this country. You described it very well, Mr. President. From the outset of this administration, we've been rebuilding our military, putting the safety and security of the American people first. You've restored American credibility on the world stage. We're standing with our allies. We're standing up to our enemies. But you promised economic renewal at home. You said we could make this economy great again. And you promised to roll back regulations. And you signed more bills rolling back federal red tape than any president in American history. You've unleashed American energy. You've spurred an optimism in this country that's setting records. But you promised the American people in that campaign a year ago that you would deliver historic tax cuts. And it would be a middle-class miracle. And in just a short period of time, that promise will be fulfilled. And I'm deeply humbled as your vice president to be able to be here. Because of your leadership, Mr. President, and because of the strong support of leadership in the Congress of the United States, you're delivering on that middle-class miracle. You've actually got the Congress to do, as you said, what they couldn't do with Anwar for 40 years. You've got the Congress to do with tax cuts for working families and American businesses what they haven't been able to do for 31 years. And you got Congress to do what they couldn't do for 7 years in repealing the individual mandate in Obamacare.
Five-star ass kissing. And Lisa, describe how Donald Trump looked as he watched on. And this been done for the cameras, for all the photographers. How did Donald Trump look during all of this?
He sat there. It was something out of the Apprentice, sort of just gazing ahead. It was like sort of emperor-like.
Arms folded.
Almost like a sort of an emperor taking, you know, plaudits from the trembling, you know, peasants. And it was quite extraordinary. You know, there wasn't even a scintilla of, you know, embarrassment, mortification, or, ah, shucks, you know, you shouldn't really. I mean, this man sat there going, like, this is my due. And, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you have the experience of North Korea firsthand, but you know, it really was. There was such a whole smell of the Dear Leader off of that. It was quite extraordinary.
Can you imagine Simon Coveney doing that in front of a camera crew at an Irish cabinet meeting?
No, because I think some form of common sense starts to kick in, especially in Ireland. It's too embarrassing in Ireland to go at that kind of guffawing and that kind of heaping praise on someone, especially in the public light. Trump loves it. Like, laps it up with Annie, just mimicked his hands.
Anything else? I mean, like, the actual, you know, the content of it was pure guff.
Well, maybe he has some achievements. Maybe he has some achievements. The economy is booming ahead. Stock market's at a record high. There are many people who feel America is a better place.
Well, are you about to say he's making America great again? I mean, I think the idea that he's actually doing things for working class people in America is absolute nonsense. Like, all of his tax cuts are really going to affect them. The repealing of Obamacare, that they have repeatedly messed up. I mean, it is just targeting almost people who don't have a lot of money, and all of his tax cuts are there to benefit the rich. So I think the lies that he told during the campaign of actually caring about working class people, they just, none of his policies have lived up to them at all. But I think that Mike Pence, I think there's almost a pressure on the people who haven't been fired from the White House, because, I mean, the exit list from the White House has just been remarkable in the past year. So I almost think, and, you know, if anything happens with Donald Trump now, I mean, there's this whole Mike Flynn investigation, there's an investigation to do with what Donald Trump knew about who lied. But I think if anything happens to Donald Trump, Mike Pence is also trying to ensure that he's not going to be put on the chopping block, that he stays on Donald Trump's side, but he also stays on the side of the law, so that if anything happens to Donald Trump, he'll be ready to take over, which I also think is terrifying. Like, I would be all for Donald Trump being impeached, but then we are left with Mike Pence, and he is also a very scary, scary individual.
Okay, Enda Kenny was there last March for Patrick's Day and issued something of a reprimand, albeit did Donald Trump understand the reprimand that he delivered to him?
Yeah, this was sort of an odd one. I was part of the travelling press corps that covered the Taoiseach's visit to the White House. Now, I've been a couple of times before, and this was sort of markedly different, because the three times I've been there during Obama's reign of pleasantness, we'd all file in and everything would be hunky-dory and there'd be little speeches and everybody would be sort of smiley and we were all let sort of roam around to take a few photographs and all that, and we'd be in the room, the Oval Office, for maybe 7 or 8 minutes. I think I set my watch to see how long we'd get in this time, and it was 90 seconds. We literally were shoved in. He sat there kind of, you know, but stony-faced. Everybody was sort of pushing each other, trying to get photographs, and there was no speeches, no nothing, completely, and then we were all pushed out the door. And afterwards, we went up to the Capitol Hill, where there are speeches made, and the Taoiseach, he was lauded all over the place for basically reminding the US president that St. Patrick had been an immigrant too. And, you know, sort of loosely tied it to the notion that he should look kindly on, you know, the undocumented Irish in America. And, you know, we sort of didn't really pay much heed to this, but the American press sort of picked up on this and had him, you know, sort of said, how brave he is. What? Oh, look at the Irish Taoiseach and him with the little sandy-haired fella. And he went and he stood up to Donald Trump. This is fantastic. And
you can understand why that was the case in the American press, though, as well. Why
they
we can
are
be
so
considerably
supine.
More cynical.
They are so supine. The American press, and I mean, I'm sure, Ro, you know this from living there, and I live there myself, you know, the deference that the American media show to the president, to the presidency, and by default to the president, has always struck me as extraordinary. And it's probably landed. That's why we probably landed with Donald Trump as it is, but you're absolutely right.
Okay, but what happens when Leo Varadkar goes there next March? Or will he go there? I wonder, will he be thinking over Christmas, is there a way I can get out of this trip to the White House? Or if he goes, how difficult is it going to be for him?
Well, I think you probably know this better than I, but I think the value of that trip, that single St. Patrick's Day every year, walk into the White House for a sit-down with the president to the United States, is so valuable that I think it's greater than the term length of Donald Trump's reign.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything that happens around it. I mean, it's, you know, the speaker's lunch. There's an awful lot of quiet business that's done in rooms up in Capitol Hill that, you know, that might open, say, trade doors and so on. Now, but I actually agree with you, because there's going to be a massive amount of interest, because there we go back to what we were talking about earlier. We have a gay prime minister of ethnic origin that's going to be going into just talk to Donald Trump, who's not exactly sort of the warm fuzzy type when it comes to dealing with matters of ethnic origin, as we have seen by his various bans.
Okay.
But, you know, the I'm not even sure that'll happen this year. I mean, Donald Trump might just turn around and go, I don't want to do it this year.
Well, indeed.
Next year.
Tom O'Brien sends in a tweet that says, sadly, Matt Cooper in The Last Word loses all journalistic objectivity at the mention of Donald Trump, becomes more like George Hook or Ivan Yates when it comes to this. Now, that's ruined my Christmas for me. But there's a reason, I suppose, for that, because I want to play a clip as well. Charlottesville was one of the worst things that happened in America this year. This was a disgraceful riot which took place for fascists. And let's hear how Donald Trump dealt with that.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt? Let me ask you this. What about the fact they came charging, that they came charging with clubs in the hand, swinging clubs? Do they have any problem? I think they do. I watched those very closely, much more closely than you people watched it. And you have, you had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent. Is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop? You're changing history, you're changing culture, and you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly.
But I suppose he did condemn the white nationalists and neo-Nazis.
Well, not in that statement. He said they should be. That's not exactly the same thing. But I think what he's doing so cannily is allowing for that separation of not everybody in the group is neo-Nazis and white nationalists. Because, of course, not a lot of people in these groups say, I am a neo-Nazi, I'm a white nationalist. They say things like, I just believe in American values. I just want to, you know, support white people. I want to protect, you know, the racial hierarchies. You know, they use this coded language and they don't self-identify like that. So what he's doing too, of course, is appealing to his base of people who do harbour bigotry, who do harbour racism, and who voted for him for those reasons, because his entire campaign, this idea of Make America Great Again, America was never great for anyone apart from white men. If you move back through history, I feel like it's like those games people play on New Year's of like, if you could travel back in time to any time. That question only ever works for white men, because if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, if you're moving back, your rights are being taken away. So the whole campaign of Make America Great Again meant take rights away from people, let's support white men again. So I think all the coded language he was using, and I mean, he tried to display this sense of balance about Charlottesville of like, oh, there are good people on both sides, there are bad people on both sides. A balance that he does not apply to any other situation.
The Me Too campaign has been one of the most extraordinary events of the year. Really took off towards the end of the year. And fascinating that it took Hollywood to bring it forward, given that we had Donald Trump over a year ago, when a whole range of allegations, very strongly substantiated allegations, in fact his own confession from a tape which emerged, didn't impact on his ability to win the election. And yet, from about October this year, there has been an extraordinary number of people who have been brought down by the revelation of various behaviour. Of course, Lisa, it actually started back in August with Taylor Swift, but didn't really get momentum at the time.
No, it didn't. I think it's one of those things that just goes to show the strength of numbers, because it doesn't matter, you know, how powerful you are or what a high profile you have. If a single, you know, a woman on her own, a solo woman, makes an accusation, there's all, immediately it's like, ah, yeah, well, I mean, she would say that, or she's a new album coming out, or, you know, she, you know, this is just some kind of, you know, we don't believe her. And really, if you look back at the at all the kind of the sexual allegations that were taken seriously, it was when women banded together and went in numbers. You saw that with Bill Cosby, again, and of course you saw it with Weinstein as well. That
Harvey
was really
Weinstein.
Where it, with Harvey Weinstein, where it really took off, because it was like a coordination of women saying, if I go on this solo, it's not going to happen. If we go in numbers, we have to be taken seriously. And I think as well, if you go back to the Trump thing, all, you know, his accusers came out, but they came out one by one by one by one. And I wonder what the effect would have been before the election if the 18, I think it's up to now, that have actually, I think it's 18 that have publicly come out and have named, if they had done, say, a cover of a magazine, all 18 together, I wonder whether that would have made a difference. Because it's,
Been just the liberal fake news media just putting a magazine cover out there to try and bring down the presidential candidate.
He did recently try to deny that it was his voice on the tape.
With Billy Bush.
After he admitted and apologised for it, and then Billy Bush came forward and was like, are you forgetting there was witnesses? Thank you very much.
Well, Billy Bush is obviously, he's on the road to try and redeem himself. Well, yeah, try and get us some kind of career back on the tracks.
Well, if he lost his career and his marriage... Yeah. And Donald Trump ended up in the White House.
I mean, no wonder he must feel a little bitter.
I do just want to mention, because I think the Me Too campaign, so a lot of credit has been given to Alyssa Milano, who started the campaign on October 15th. So she encouraged people spreading the phrase as part of this awareness campaign and said, if all women who have been sexually harassed or assaulted wrote Me Too as a status, we might give people a sense of the magnitude of the problem. However, I do just want to, I feel like it's important to point out that the Me Too campaign was actually started by a black woman called Tarana Burke back in 2006. And her desire was to spread empathy and awareness about sexual violence committed against women of colour. And I think what has emerged about Me Too, I think it's been such an important platform for women to come forward, and an effective platform, thankfully, and hopefully it will continue. But I do think there is a racial element to the Me Too campaign, and it has been criticised for ignoring the plights of women of colour. And even if you look at Harvey Weinstein, so I think, I can't even remember how many people have come out and accused Harvey Weinstein at this stage, it's up to about 60, but the only two people that he spoke back to and whose claims he tried to discredit were Lupita Nyong'o and Selma Hayek, so two women of colour. So there was this really horrible racial aspect to even his response to them, that like, I'll take it from white women, but I won't take it from women of colour. And I think it is just important to acknowledge the source of the Me Too campaign was Tarana Burke.
Yeah, I think Selma Hayek, her revelations only came out quite recently. Mm. And I think that hers were quite extraordinary, because I think they really delved down into just how the power, like his absolute power, corrupted absolutely, because she was absolutely unable to do anything about his constant harassing of her, his constant hounding of her. And, she just wrote this incredibly vivid piece about the whole experience that is quite extraordinary. And again, she summed up, I think, what an awful lot of women felt about it was the whole powerlessness of the situation, because this is always about power, you still get people to think this is about sex. It's not. It is not about sex. It's about power.
Hmm. Well, what about the president who was brought down, Kevin Spacey from House of Cards?
yeah, obviously a fictitious president indeed, but his allegations were slightly, they were different in that they entered into a same-sex area, and for the most part, I think, as far as I know, all the Weinstein ones were heterosexual all the way through. What happened with Spacey was you also had an underage accuser, you had a 14-year-old boy who was pinned to a bed. It was so graphic. And then there was lots of other things that came out at the time where I think he broke that story anonymously first without naming Spacey, and then he did it again naming Spacey that time. That was just an incredible story in the way it happened. But I think
What about the argument, though, that if people do have a legitimate complaint to make, what they should do is they should go to the authorities, get prosecution brought, rather than naming and shaming somebody publicly, that you have effectively a Twitter court, a court of public opinion, a mob rule, rather than actually having proper procedures go through?
If this is going to be beneficial in the long term, which it has been obviously in the short term, there needs to be a way that we can work out that this is how you deal with sexual allegations in the future, because what it is at the moment is way too dangerous and way too autonomous and all this kind of stuff. But if at the end of all this is a procedure of, like, you've been sexually harassed, you go and you do this, that and the other, here's very clear guidelines as to what you do, and then it's resolved come the end of it. If there isn't that at the end of it, it just doesn't seem like it can't go on the same way it's going on now, by having like repeated
I think it's slightly naive to say that we need to just go through the proper authorities, because women have tried to go through the proper authorities historically, and the proper authorities have not supported women. Like, it's almost impossible to get a rape conviction. I think it's 3% of rape cases go to trial and actually there is a conviction at the end of it. And then to say, well, we're going to deal with groping, which is kind of harder to prove, there's less DNA evidence. The proper channels have not served women. And even if you look at kind of HR in big companies, like you look look at Susan Fowler's counts of trying to bring sexual harassment claims against people in Uber, and the HR department themselves covering up these allegations because they were made against men who were bringing in revenue and capital for the companies. Proper journals have not served women. So I think it's a larger issue of rape culture and how women are treated and how sexual violence is treated and sexual harassment. And I think one thing that really did emerge in the Taylor Swift case, and I'm not the hugest fan of her and think she can be slightly problematic, but I think one thing that emerged in her court case was just how endlessly brilliantly quotable it was, and how she had great responses to all the very shaming questioning that was brought forth by David Mueller's lawyer. So she's, you know, she was asked, should Swift be critical of her bodyguard for failing to protect her from being groped? And her response was, I'm critical of your client sticking his hand under my skirt and grabbing my ass. And it was this very determined, no, I'm not taking the blame. The blame lies on nobody else except the man who groped me. And I think so the case itself was very empowering in that sense, that it took all the questions that women are asked after sexual violence, like what should you have done to prevent this, and said, no, the responsibility is on you and you alone.
Okay, not disagreeing with any of that, but Lisanne, what about the fact that sometimes an allegation can be made, the damage is done, but the allegation may not stick?
Well, I think this goes back to what Michael says, is that, you know, unfortunately, there, you know, in an ideal world, you know, some kind of process should be put in place, or some kind of structure where, you know, allegations can be made in a sort of safe environment. They will be taken seriously. They will be followed up with, you know, a certain level of protection for both the, you know, the accused and the alleged victim before it goes public. But, you know, again, as Rose says, you know, the conviction rate of rape and sexual assault, particularly even in Ireland, is absolutely it's abysmally low. I mean, you know, you have to look back to, you know, eventually after absolute pressure from all sorts, you know, the government have finally conceded they want to do a new Savvy report, which is, you know, a report looking at sexual assault and violence in Ireland. The last one was 2002, I think it was 2002. And they, you know, they have just point blank refused to cough up the 1 million, you know, which is pretty small in terms of income, to try and have a look at just the level and of sexual assault and violence in Ireland, and, you know, the prevalence of it and who's affected by it. And the, you know, the last report showed that the conviction rate was absolutely, I think we were something at the third lowest conviction rate in Europe or something, which is, you know, absolutely insane. So it's not surprising that people take to social media in order to, it's not ideal, but until something better is put in place, it's going to keep happening.
Okay, last word on this particular topic, just before we have the competition.
I will say, we had the Michael Colgan case here in Ireland. I think Grace Diaz had an incredible piece of writing on her Tumblr, where she wrote about the danger of putting too much faith in reports, and how Ireland loves doing reports into these things, and then we release these findings and we say, oh, this many people were abused, or this many people have faced violence, and then we think it's done and dusted and we kind of don't do anything about it. And I think that is slightly the danger of putting so much faith into investigations and reports, that we actually don't do anything culturally to move on from these issues. So I think that is my kind of wariness about reports being done and investigations. I think it has to start as a cultural issue. And one thing just on what Michael was speaking about, I think it can't be overlooked as well that the Me Too campaign has also allowed men to come forward and talk about their experiences of abuse. So people like James Van Der Beek and Terry Crews have come forward and spoken not only about their experiences of abuse, and I think male survivors of sexual violence are often overlooked and really shouldn't be, but also the stigma that they faced was really sad. So I think we also have to look at how we treat men and male survivors of abuse.
Okay, what we're going to do now, Daniel Kahl has put together for us a montage of some of the most notable deaths of the year.
I don't know what the connection is quite. Quentin did. He said, whatever you do, you play me. He said, in I, Claudius, it was me in a toga.
Yeah.
In The Elephant Man, it was me with a paper bag over his head.
Started out.
Naturally, you didn't know I was wearing my special Super Thermal B long underwear for extreme cold.
Well, actually, Captain, I'm with the British Secret Service. The name is Bond. James Bond.
The Playboy philosophy makes a case for life as a celebration, with the suggestion that there is more to life than simply a veil of tears. that life should be lived with a little style.
What right have you? You're hard up for a quid, you Madison, that's rolling in it and then rake it in.
Hey, now, hang on a
minute. No, you hang on. Listen, you can stick your papers, lady. Because they only tell me what I already know. The world stinks.
I literally was put on the cover of a magazine and they said, this is the it, girl.
And I'm an Irish Republican and absolutely dedicated to ending partition and bringing about the unity of the people of the North and the North with the South. And we've agreed in the context of the Good Friday Agreement that that can only change through a constitutional vote, and I'm working to achieve that.
Good evening, ladies, gentlemen and children. Welcome to the Generation Game. Nice to see you. To see you.
But for the real family entertainment, it is most sublime. You'll have to wait till after Christmas when Star Wars opens in London. Even by the standards of Hollywood, a place where nothing succeeds like excess, Star Wars is a phenomenon. It only opened in America at the end of May, but already it's the biggest box office hit in cinema history.
I've found my thrill.
Every year there used to be this festival of Irish culture on in Finsbury Park in London called The Fla. And it was brilliant the first year because they actually had some Irish acts on. And second year was a bit odd. We're all still celebrating being Irish from listening to fucking Crowded House and Neil Young.
And as I went home on a Tuesday night, as drunk could be, I saw a coat behind the door where my old coat should be.
Enrique to Maradona.
We sell a Lynn's Gabe over in Dublin, and we'd have a good feed of rashers and sausages. Because, and we were always saying we should have had corn flakes and a banana, but if it was Kilkenny you were playing, I think you really needed the rashers and the sausages.
And don't forget the Weetabix as well.
And the Weetabix. Singing in the wire, and I can hear you through the wind,
and the Wichita. Kind of got it by the end, and he stopped halfway through and took a break from reading it and said his beautiful quote about it's fucking mental being stuck inside your head, Ruth, I had to take a break. And I said, that's the most romantic thing you've ever said to me. But it don't look like rain.
And if it snows. And of course, the last voice you heard there was Ruth Fitzmaurice talking earlier this year about her book about Simon, who died a couple of months afterwards. And that was one of my favourite interviews of the year with Ruth Fitzmaurice about her fantastic book. I'll just go through the list of all the people that you would have heard there. Just how many of them would you have recognised? It started with Tom Petty, John Hurt, the actor, Adam West, Batman fame, Joni Sledge from Sister Sledge, Roger Moore, the James Bond, Robert Miles, Hugh Hefner, Malcolm Young of AC/DC, Liz Dawn, the actress from Coronation Street, Chester Bennington from Linkin Park, Tara Palmer Tomkinson, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, Martin McGuinness, Mary Tyler Moore, very famous actress from the 70s in particular, Bruce Forsyth, Walter Becker from the band Steely Dan, Barry Norman, the BBC movie critic, Fats Domino, Sean Hughes, the comedian who was only in his early 50s, Eamon Campbell from the Dubliners, Jimmy McGee, the great RT commentator, Chuck Berry, Tony Keady, the former Galway hurler, and Glenn Campbell, who we there heard in the last bit of music, and of course Ruth Fitzmaurice talking about her husband Simon. Of all those, Lise, you might have interviewed quite a few of them along the years as well. Who in particular stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I suppose I was lucky enough to have spent some time in the company of Eamon Campbell.
Of the Dubliners.
And a truly wonderful man. I mean, a truly wonderful individual. Just one of those, you know, had always had the genuine sparkle in his eye and the sort of real kind of cackle, and was always up for any kind of devilment as well. I mean, I'll just like a brief story, which I think sort of sums up Eamon. I had to get an early morning train up from Tralee many, many years ago, having covered the roads to Tralee, and previous to that I'd spent 3 or 4 days on the road to the Pogues, so you can imagine the state I was in. And I got
the Pogues weren't at the Rose of Tralee, were they?
They were. They actually played at the Rose. Yeah, they did. They were playing in Tralee at the same time. They weren't sort of part of the Rose. But I spent a few days on the road. Now, I was not in good shape. 7 a.m. train, and I put my head down on the table to sleep, and next thing I just hear, "How are you, young hand? How are you?" So I look up, and there's Eamon Campbell and the rest of the Dubliners budge up there in the seat. So anyway, I budged up at the seat, and Eamon and the others dragged the others in. We all sat down, and I swear to God, before we were out of the station, there was beer, and out came the fiddles and out came the guitars, and Eamon led the entire carriage in a complete and utter sing-song, probably the whole way up to Dublin. I mean, he was one of those people who was just always full of life, and, you know, he was great. So on a personal level, you know, he's probably the one I'd miss. The one I would love to see a film of their life, though, is Fats Domino. I mean, he had a fascinating life, absolutely fascinating. I think he had something like 13 children. He sold, you know, millions, tens of millions of records. He influenced so many artists throughout the years. And then, of course, you know, there was an extraordinary incident at the end of his life when he was living in the ninth, he was living in the ninth ward in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina struck. And he went missing, and everybody thought he had died in the hurricane and or died in the floods. And he had actually been rescued by the Coast Guard and was sort of found in a shelter about 3 or 4 days later. And he actually made a kind of a record thanking everybody on the back of that. I mean, an extraordinary character, you know, and an amazing... I'd love to see, like, a really good biopic of his life.
In 2018, we are due to have a presidential election. We will have a referendum on the 8th. We may even have a general election. But I'm not going to talk about those now. The other things we might look forward to in 2018. How much interest will there be in Ireland in the marriage of a British royal to an American actress? Lise?
Well, I think probably because it's Prince Harry who's sort of, you know, out of all the royals, I mean, let's face it, William and Kate are so boring. So boring. So, you know, at least he's kind of got the kind of whiff of sulfur off him, and he's, you know, you never really know what the hell he's going to do. There's a bit of the old sort of a devilish kind of thing going on there. I mean, you know, everybody likes to tune in and just have a look and see what her, you know, her dress looks like, and, you know, that kind of carry on, and do the more aged royals make it up the aisle of, you know, Westminster Abbey without carking it halfway up or whatever. But, you know, there's not that much. There won't be a huge amount of interest in it. You know, it'll be something to look at for the day. But, I mean, we will watch the, as Britain, in their newfound nationalism flag, like Union Jack waving, wrap the, you know, the white cliffs of Dover around me, like, kind of attitude. They will go... Over. Bananas.
Your man to the left of you there could actually play Prince Harry.
Oh, my goodness. For those of us watching us on radio, he is a similar colouring, height, build, and even facial hair configuration to Prince Harry, you know? So, yeah, absolutely.
It is interesting, though, the way the British are taking to this. Because it's slightly when you think that they're not quite sure what to make of some of it. This American actress, previously married, also that she's a woman of colour as well.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting is how she's being described by the media, and there is so much focus on her race, but often it doesn't get beyond the fact that, yes, she is biracial, her mother is African-American and her father is white. But I think it's interesting, and it's interesting to look back on even Obama's initial campaign, because Obama was campaigning, he was the first mixed race or biracial candidate, and then when he got into office, it was, no, he's the first black president. And it was this very political statement, like, no, we have a black person in the White House, this is progress. So I think it'll be interesting, because people are saying, like, oh, you know, she's biracial and that's really interesting, but when she get in, is she going to become suddenly the first black princess, because this will be a statement that Britain has moved on and it's very progressive. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how Britain responds to it culturally, and whether they take this as a symbol of, yes, we've moved on. And of course, we, again, using the comparison of Obama, we've seen that having the first biracial or black president in the office did not eradicate racism in the USA, and there was in fact a huge pushback. So I think it'll be interesting to see how Britain responds to it.
But it's also interesting, it's the next sort of in the production line of reality soap stars in the British royalty, then she's effectively helping to fill a gap, isn't it? Because as Lee said, Michael, they were getting very dull and boring. They have a brand that they need to protect, so there she is, she's very useful for that brand. But how, does she know what she's let herself in for, I wonder?
Well, maybe I'm being naive in thinking that I don't think Harry was thinking about brand awareness when he fell in love with the woman, but I don't think
it's so nice to have an answer.
It's definitely a lack of cynicism, but anyway, I think as well from her perspective, like, it's the international reputation that she holds makes it so interesting for overseas viewers when you see like the how famous she was in Suits. Like, Suits was extremely popular for a very long time. It's a little start to tail off for being a terrible show towards near the end, but you'd wonder, like, she's already a celebrity, she already has the money, she has everything as it is. To go into that kind of public life is very unusual, but then can you reject the opportunity to be a princess of, and the princess of England? Like, there's a lot to it. So this kind
such
of
a terrible job. I mean, all you do is you just go around and open things and take bouquets of flowers and say nothing.
I would love that.
I would take
that. Oh,
yeah, you see, well, there
if
you.
My job was to
have you not been
collect
watching it. The Crown? No,
no, I've been told to repeatedly.
You should.
But there is an inherent snobbery. I mean, as Ro points out. If you recall when Kate Middleton, before they got engaged, herself and William got engaged, all the kind of hooray Henrys, used to scoff about Kate Middleton because she came from a sort of a middle class background and her mother had been an air hostess, and her nickname among the kind of hoorays was, something like Doors to Manual or something like this, because her mother had been an air hostess. So, I mean, what the hoorays are going to make of... of the latest addition to the royal family it'll make some really interesting headlines and probably lots of torturous puns coming up today as well.
Interesting to see.
Listener here says, stop slagging off the English. If you don't like them, don't watch English channels. The Irish fascination with their neighbours is stalker-esque. Remember, there are a lot of us English living here listening to your crap.
Yeah, do you remember when we were stalking them for 800 years? That was definitely us.
Yeah, no, I'm a pro in this. It takes a while to kind of unshackle ourselves from 800 years of oppression. You know what I mean? I have to get used to stop tugging my forelock. It's kind of like
In fairness, I thought particularly 2011 when Queen Elizabeth came to visit, relations between these countries have never been better, and there is so many bonds that tie the two countries together. I think 1 in 6 English people has Irish heritage. I think it's a figure like that. You'd probably correct me on that, but.
Things
in the last few weeks have actually created a bit of a division, but we've actually had to stand up for ourselves to an extent, and just the British are gone nuts with our Brexit stuff.
Well, criticise ourselves all the time.
We do. You know, and I mean, I think, look, I was lucky enough to cover the Queen Elizabeth's visit here, and it was genuinely, as a professional, one of the most enjoyable weeks I ever had, because I had gone to so many, security briefings beforehand when there was all worried about when thing would happen or while she's here and all that, and I kind of wrapped her in cotton wool for the first couple of days, and then they suddenly realised that the Irish people were actually up for this and they were kind of game for it. And, her sort of the gestures in the Garden of Remembrance and, I think sort of softened a lot of people's hearts. And I was lucky enough to be sort of in the hall, the Great Hall in Dublin Castle, during the speech when she stood up and she spoke the Cúpla Focail. And there was a genuine surge of electricity in the room. I mean, people kind of went, this is just amazing. And it was great crack. Mm. And it did definitely improve relations to a point where, I think we were able to look at each other and sort of say, we're equals now. And now we're in a situation where we are looking at them going, they've gone nuts, they've gone crazy, they're losing the run.
I have to leave it there, we're out of time. Thank you for all your contributions over the year to The Last Word and today as well. Ro McDermott from Hot Press and Lise Hand and Michael Cogby from The Times Ireland Edition.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.